There was an old forge behind the barn. It hadn't been used for years, but now red and yellow light spilled out into the yard, pulsing like a heart. And like a heart, there was a regular thumping. With every crash, the light flared blue. Miss Flitworth sidled through the open doorway. If she was the kind of person who would swear, she would have sworn that she made no noise that could possibly be heard above the crackle of the fire and the hammering. But Bill Dawe spun round in a half-crouch, holding a curved blade in front of him.
"It's me!"
He relaxed, or at least moved into a different level of tension.
"What the hell are you doing?"
He looked at the blade in his hands as if he was seeing it for the first time.
"I thought I would sharpen this scythe, Miss Flitworth."
"At 1 o'clock in the morning?"
He looked at it blankly.
"It's just as blunt at night, Miss Flitworth."
Then he slammed it down on the anvil.
"And I can't sharpen it enough."
"I think perhaps the heat has got to you,"
she said, and reached out and took his arm.
"Besides, it looks sharp enough to—"
She began and paused. Her fingers moved on the bone of his arm. They pulled away for a moment and then closed again. Bill Dawe shivered. Miss Flitworth didn't hesitate for long. In 75 years she had dealt with wars, famine, innumerable sick animals, a couple of epidemics, and thousands of tiny everyday tragedies. A depressed skeleton wasn't even in the top 10 worst things she had seen.
"So it is you," she said.
"Miss Flitworth, I..."
"I always knew you would come one day."
"I think perhaps that..."
"You know, I spent most of my life waiting for a knight on a white charger," Miss Flitworth grinned. "The joke's on me, eh?"
Bill Dawe sat down on the anvil.
"The apothecary came," she said. "He said he couldn't do anything. He said she was fine. We just couldn't wake her up. And you know, it took us ages to get her hand open. She had it closed so tightly."
"I said nothing was to be taken."
"It's all right, it's all right. We left her holding it."
"Good."
"What was it?"
"My time."
"Sorry?"
"My time. The time of my life."
"It looks like an egg timer for very expensive eggs."
Bill Dawe looked surprised.
"Yes, in a way, I have given her some of my time."
"How come you need time?"
"Every living thing needs time, and when it runs out, they die. When it runs out, she will die. And I will die too, in a few hours."
"But you can't."
"I can. It's hard to explain."
"Move up."
"What?"
"I said move up. I want to sit down."
Bill Dawe made space on the anvil. Miss Flitworth sat down.
"So, you're going to die," she said.
"Yes."
"And you don't want to?"
"No."
"Why not?"
He looked at her as if she was mad.
"Because then there will be nothing. Because I won't exist."
"Is that what happens for humans, too?"
"I don't think so. It's different for you. You have it all better organized."
They both sat watching the fading glow of the coals in the forge.
"So what were you working on the scythe blade for?" said Miss Flitworth.
"I thought perhaps I could fight back."
"Has it ever worked? With you, I mean?"
"Not usually. Some people challenge me to a game for their lives, you know."
"Do they ever win?"
"No. Last year someone got 3 streets and all the utilities."
"What? What sort of a game is that?"
"I don't recall. Exclusive possession, I think. I was the boot."
"Just a moment," said Miss Flitworth. "If you are you, who will be coming for you?"
"Death. Last night, this was pushed under the door."
Death opened his hand to reveal a small grubby piece of paper on which Miss Flitworth could read, with some difficulty, the word
OOEOOEOEOEOEOEOEOE. "I have received the badly written note of the Banshee."
Miss Flitworth looked at him with her head on one side.
"But, correct me if I'm wrong, but..."
"The new death."
Bill Dawe picked up the blade.
"He will be terrible."
The blade twisted in his hands. Blue light flickered along its edge.
"I will be the first."
Miss Flitworth stared at the light as if fascinated.
"Exactly How terrible?
How terrible can you imagine?
Oh.
Exactly as terrible as that.
The blade tilted this way and that.
And for the child, too, said Miss Flitworth.
Yes.
I don't reckon I owe you any favours, Mr. Dawe. I don't reckon anyone in the whole world owes you any favours.
You may be right.
Mind you, life's got one or two things to answer for, too. Fair's fair.
I cannot say.
Miss Flitworth gave him another long, appraising look.
There's a pretty good grindstone in the corner, she said.
I've used it.
And there's an oil stone in the cupboard.
I've used that, too.
She thought she could hear a sound as the blade moved, a sort of faint whine of tensed air.
And it's still not sharp enough.
Bildor sighed.
It may never be sharp enough.
Come on, man, no sense in giving in, said Miss Flitworth. Where there's life, eh?
Where there's life, eh? What?
There's hope.
Is there?
Right enough.
Bildor ran a bony finger along the edge.
Hope?
Got anything else left to try?
Bill shook his head. He tried a number of emotions, but this was a new one.
Could you fetch me a steel?
It was an hour later. Miss Flitworth sorted through her rag bag.
What next? She said.
What have we had so far?
Let's see. Hessian calico linen. How about satin? Here's a piece.
Bildor took the rag and wiped it gently along the blade. Miss Flitworth reached the bottom of the bag and pulled out a swatch of white cloth.
Yes?
Silk, she said softly. Finest white silk, the real stuff, never worn.
She sat back and stared at it. After a while, he took it tactfully from her fingers.
Thank you.
Well now, she said, waking up. That's it, isn't it?
When he turned the blade, it made a noise like whoom. The fires of the forge were barely alive now, but the blade glowed with razor light.
Sharpened on silk, said Miss Flitworth. Who'd believe it?
And still blunt.
Bildor looked around the dark forge and then darted into a corner.
What have you found?
Cobweb.
There was a long, thin whine, like the torturing of ants.
Any good?
Still too blunt.
She watched Bildor stride out of the forge and scuttled after him. He went and stood in the middle of the yard, holding the scythe blade edge on to the faint dawn breeze. It hummed.
Oh, how sharp can a blade get, for goodness sake?
It can get sharper than this.
Down in his henhouse, Cyril the Cockerel awoke and stared blearily at the treacherous letters chalked on the board. He took a deep breath.
Flew a cockle-dod.
Bildor glanced at the rimwood horizon and then speculatively at the little hill behind the house. He jerked forward, legs clicking over the ground. The new daylight sloshed onto the world. Discworld light is old, slow and heavy. It roared across the landscape like a cavalry charge. The occasional valley slowed it for a moment, and here and there a mountain range banked it up until it poured over the top and down the far slope. It moved across a sea, surged up the beach, and accelerated over the plains driven by the lash of the sun. On the fabled hidden continent of X, somewhere near the rim, there is a lost colony of wizards who wear corks around their pointy hats and live on nothing but prawns. There the light is still wild and fresh as it rolls in from space, and they surf on the boiling interface between night and day. If one of them had been carried thousands of miles inland on the dawn, he might have seen, as the light thundered over the high plains, a stick figure toiling up a low hill in the path of the morning. It reached the top a moment before the light arrived, took a breath, then spun around in a crouch, grinning. It held a long blade upright between extended arms. Light struck, split, slid. Not that the wizard would have paid much attention, because he'd be too busy worrying about the 5,000-mile walk back home. Miss Flitworth panted up as the new day streamed past. Bildor was absolutely still, only the blade moving between his fingers as he angled it against the light. Finally, he seemed satisfied. He turned around and swished it experimentally through the air. Miss Flitworth stuck her hands on her hips.
Oh, come on, she said.
No one can sharpen any thing on daylight.
She paused. He waved the blade again.
Good grief!
Down in the yard, Cyril stretched his bald neck for another go. Bill Dorr grinned and swung the blade towards the sound.
Sood and noodle fod.
Then he lowered the blade.
That's sharp.
His grin faded, or at least faded as much as it was able to. Miss Flitworth turned, following the line of his gaze, until it intersected a faint haze over the cornfields. It looked like a pale grey robe, empty but still somehow maintaining the shape of its wearer, as if a garment on a washing line was catching the breeze. It wavered for a moment and then vanished.
I saw it, said Miss Flitworth.
That wasn't it. That was them.
Them who?
They're like, Bill Dorr waved a hand vaguely, servants, watchers, auditors, inspectors.
Miss Flitworth's eyes narrowed.
Inspectors? You mean like the revenue? She said.
I suppose so.
Miss Flitworth's face lit up.
Why didn't you say?
I'm sorry.
My father always made me promise never to help the revenue. Even just thinking about the revenue, he said, made him want to go and have a lie down. He said that there was death and taxes was worse, because at least death didn't happen to you every year. We had to go out of the room when he really got started about the revenue. Nasty creatures, always poking around, asking what you've got hidden under the woodpile and behind the secret panels in the cellar and other stuff which is no concern whatsoever of anyone.
She sniffed. Bill Dorr was impressed. Miss Flitworth could actually give the word revenue, which had two vowels and one diphthong, all the peremptoriness of the word scum.
You should have said that they were after you right from the start, said Miss Flitworth. The revenue aren't popular in these parts, you know. In my father's day, any revenuer came round here, prying around by himself, we used to tie weights to the feet and heave them into the pond.
But the pond is only a few inches deep, Miss Flitworth.
Yeah, but it was fun watching them find out. You should have said everyone thought you were to do with taxes.
No, not taxes.
Well, well, I didn't know there was a revenue up there, too.
Yes, in a way.
She sidled closer.
When will he come?
Tonight. I cannot be exact. Two people are living on the same timer. It makes things uncertain.
I didn't know people could give people some of their life.
It happens all the time.
And you're sure about tonight?
Yes.
And that blade will work, will it?
I don't know. It's a million to one chance.
Oh.
She seemed to be considering something.
So you've got the rest of the day free, then?
Yes.
Then you can start getting the harvest in.
What?
It'll keep you busy, keep your mind off things. Besides, I'm paying you sixpence a week, and sixpence is sixpence.
Mrs. Cake's house was also in Elm Street. Windle knocked on the door. After a while, a muffled voice called out,
"Is there anybody there?"
"Knock once for yes,"
Schleppel volunteered. Windle levered open the letterbox.
Mrs. Cake?"
The door opened. Mrs. Cake wasn't what Windle had expected. She was big, but not in the sense of being fat. She was just built to a scale slightly larger than normal. The sort of person who goes through life crouching slightly and looking apologetic in case they inadvertently loom. And she had magnificent hair. It crowned her head and flowed out behind her like a cloak. She also had slightly pointed ears and teeth, which, while white and quite beautiful, caught the light in a disturbing way. Windle was amazed at the speed at which his heightened zombie senses reached a conclusion. He looked down. Lupine was sitting bolt upright, too excited even to wag his tail.
"I don't think you could be Mrs. Cake," said Windle. "You want Mother," said the tall girl. "Mother, there's a gentleman."
A distant muttering became a closer muttering, and then Mrs. Cake appeared around the side of her daughter like a small moon emerging from planetary shadow.
"What do you want?"
said Mrs. Cake. Windle took a step backwards. Unlike her daughter, Mrs. Cake was quite short and almost perfectly circular. And still unlike her daughter, whose whole stance was dedicated to making herself look small, she loomed tremendously. This was largely because of her hat, which he later learned she wore at all times with the dedication of a wizard. It was huge and black and had things on it, like bird wings and wax cherries and hat pins. Carmen Miranda could have worn that hat to the funeral of a continent. Mrs. Cake travelled underneath it as the basket travels under the balloon. People often found themselves talking to her hat.
Mrs. Cake, said Windle, fascinated.
I'm down here, said a reproachful voice.
Windle lowered his gaze.
That's who I am, said Mrs. Cake.
Am I addressing Mrs. Cake? Said Windle.
Yes, I know, said Mrs. Cake.
My name's Windle Poons.
I know that too.
I'm a wizard, you see.
All right, but see you wipes your feet.
May I come in?
Windle Poons paused. He replayed the last few lines of conversation in the clicking control room of his brain, and then he smiled.
That's right, said Mrs. Cake.
Are you by any chance a natural clairvoyant?
About 10 seconds, usually, Mr. Poons.
Windle hesitated.
You got to ask the question, said Mrs. Cake quickly. I gets a migraine if people goes and viciously not asks questions after I've already foreseen 'em and answered 'em.
How far into the future can you see, Mrs. Cake?
She nodded.
Right, then, she said, apparently mollified, and led the way through the hall into a tiny sitting room. And the bogey can come in, only he's got to leave his door outside and go into the cellar. I don't hold with bogeys wandering around the ass.
Gosh, it's ages since I've been in a proper cellar, said Schleppel.
It's got spiders in it, said Mrs. Cake.
Wow.
And you'd like a cup of tea, said Mrs. Cake, to Windle.
Someone else might have said, I expect you'd like a cup of tea, or do you want a cup of tea? But this was a statement.
Yes, please, said Windle. I'd love a cup of tea.
You shouldn't, said Mrs. Cake. That stuff rots your teeth.
Windle worked this one out.
2 sugars, please, he said.
It's all right.
This is a nice place you have here, Mrs. Cake, said Windle, his mind racing.
Mrs. Cake's habit of answering questions while they were still forming in your mind taxed the most active brain.
He's been dead for 10 years, she said.
Said
Windle, but the question was already there in his larynx.
I trust Mr. Cake is in good health?
It's okay. I speaks to him occasional, said Mrs. Cake.
I'm sorry to hear that, said Windle.
All right, if it makes you feel any better.
Mrs. Cake, I'm finding it a little confusing. Could you switch off your precognition?
She nodded.
Sorry, I gets into the habit of leaving it on, she said, what with there only being me and Ludmilla and one man bucket.
He's a ghost, she added. I knew you was going to ask that.
Yes, I had heard that mediums have native spirit guides, said Windle.
Him? He's not a guide, he's a sort of odd-job ghost, said Mrs. Cake. I don't hold with all that stuff with cards and trumpets and ooh-jar boards, mind you. And I think ectoplasm's disgusting. I won't have it in the house, I won't. You can't get it out of the carpets, you know, not even with vinegar.
My word, said Windle Poons.
Or wailing, I don't hold with it. Or messing around with the supernatural. It's unnatural, the supernatural. I won't have it.
Said
Windle cautiously. There are those who might think that being a medium is just a bit, well, you know, supernatural.
What? What? Nothing supernatural about dead people. Load of nonsense. Everyone dies sooner or later.
I do hope so, Mrs. Cake.
So what is it you'd be wanting, Mr. Poons? I'm not precognitin, so you'll have to tell me.
I want to know what's happening, Mrs. Cake.
There was a muted thump from under their feet and the faint, happy sound of Schleppel.
Oh, wow! Rats, too!
I went up and tried to tell you, wizards, said Mrs. Cake primly, and no one listened. I knew they weren't going to, but I had to try, otherwise I wouldn't have known.
Who did you speak to?
The big one with the red dress and a moustache like he's trying to swallow a cat.
Ah, the Arch-Chancellor, said Windle positively.
And there was a huge fat one, walks like a duck.
He does, doesn't he? That was the Dean, said Windle.
"'They call me their good woman,' said Mrs. Cake. "'They told me to be about my business. "'I don't see why I should go around helping wizards "'who call me a good woman when I was only trying to help.'
"'I'm afraid wizards don't often listen,' said Windle. "'I never listened for 130 years.'
"'Why not?'
"'In case I heard what rubbish I was saying, I expect. "'What's happening, Mrs. Cake? You can tell me. "'I may be a wizard, but I'm a dead one.
Well, Schleppel told me it was all due to life force. It's building up, see?
What does that mean?
There's more of it than there should be. You get, she waved her hands vaguely, when things are like in scales, only not the same on both sides.
Imbalance.
Mrs. Cake, who looked as though she was reading a distant script, nodded. One of them things, yeah, see, sometimes it just happens a little bit and you get ghosts, because the life is not in the body anymore, but it hasn't gone, and you get less of it in the winter, because it sort of drains away, and it comes back in the spring, and some things concentrate it. Modo, the university gardener, hummed a little tune as he wheeled the strange trolley into his private little area between the library and the high-energy magic building, with a load of weeds bound for composthood. The only building on the campus less than 1,000 years old. The senior wizards have never bothered much about what the younger, skinnier and more respectable wizards get up to in there, treating their endless requests for funding for the thaumic particle accelerators and radiation shielding as one treats pleas for more pocket money, and listening with amusement to their breathless accounts of the search for the elementary particles of magic itself. This may one day turn out to be a major error on the part of the senior wizards, especially if they do let the younger wizards build whatever that blasted thing is they keep wanting to build in the squash court. The senior wizards know that the proper purpose of magic is to form a social pyramid with the wizards on top of it, eating big dinners, but in fact the HEM building has helped provide one of the rarest foods in the universe, antipasta. Ordinary pasta is prepared some hours before being eaten. Antipasta is created some hours after the meal, whereupon it then exists backwards in time, and if properly prepared should arrive on the taste buds at exactly the same moment, thus creating a true taste explosion. It costs $5,000 a forkful, or a little more if you include the cost of cleaning the tomato sauce off the walls afterwards. There seemed to be a lot of excitement around at the moment. It was certainly interesting working with all these wizards. Teamwork, that's what it was. They looked after the cosmic balance, the universal harmonies, and the dimensional equilibriums, and he saw to it that the aphids stayed off the roses. There was a metallic tinkle. He peered over the top of the heap of weeds. Another one. A gleaming metal wire basket on little wheels sat on the path. Maybe the wizards had bought it for him? The first one was quite useful, although it was a little bit hard to steer. The little wheels seemed to want to go in different directions. There was probably a knack. Well, this one would be handy for carrying seed trays in. He pushed the second trolley aside and heard, behind him, a sound which, if it had to be written down, and if he could write, he would probably have written down as glop. He turned around, saw the biggest of the compost heaps pulsating in the dark, and said, "Look what I have brought you for your tea." And then he saw that it was moving.
"Some places, too," said Mrs. Cake.
"But why should it build up?" said Windle.
"It's like a thunderstorm, see? You know how you get that prickly feeling before a storm? That's what's happening now."
"Yes, yes, but why, Mrs. Cake?"
"Well, one man bucket says nothing's dying."
"What?"
"Daft, isn't it? He says lots of lives are ending, but not going away. They're just staying here."
"What, like ghosts?"
"Not just ghosts. Just, it's like puddles. When you get a lot of puddles, it's like the sea. Anyway, you only get ghosts from things like people. You don't get ghosts of cabbages."
Windle Poons sat back in his chair. He had a vision of a vast pool of life, a lake being fed by a million short-lived tributaries, as living things came to the end of their span. And life force was leaking out of the pressure built up, leaking out wherever it could.
"Do you think I could have a word with one?"
he began, and then stopped. He got up and lurched over to Mrs. Cake's mantelpiece.
"How long have you had this, Mrs. Cake?"
he demanded, picking up a familiar glassy object.
That, ah, bought it yesterday. Pretty, ain't it?
Windle shook the globe. It was almost identical to the ones under his floorboards. Snowflakes whirled up and settled on an exquisite model of unseen university. It reminded him strongly of something. Well, the building obviously reminded him of the university, but the shape of the whole thing, there was a hint of it. It made him think of breakfast?
Why is it happening? He said, half to himself. These damn things are turning up everywhere.
The wizards ran down the corridor.
How can you kill ghosts?
How should I know? The question doesn't usually arise.
You exercise them, I think.
What, jumping up and down, running on the spot, that kind of thing?
The dean had been ready for this.
It's spelled with an O, Arch-Chancellor. I don't think one is expected to subject them to physical exertion.
Should think not, man. We don't want a lot of healthy ghosts buzzing around.
There was a blood-curdling scream. It echoed around the dark pillars and arches and was suddenly cut off. The Arch-Chancellor stopped abruptly. The wizards cannoned into him.
"Sounded like a blood-curdling scream," he said. "Follow me."
He ran around the corner. There was a metallic crash and a lot of swearing. Something small and striped red and yellow, with tiny dripping fangs and three pairs of wings, flew around the corner and shot over the dean's head, making a noise like a miniature buzzsaw.
"Anyone know what that was?"
said the bursar faintly. The thing orbited the wizards and then disappeared into the darkness of the roof.
"And I wish he wouldn't swear so."
"Come on," said the dean. "We'd better see what's happened to him."
"Must we?"
said the senior wrangler. They peered round the corner. The Arch-Chancellor was sitting up, rubbing his ankle.
"What idiot left this here?"
he said.
"Left what?"
said the dean.
"This blasted wire-baskety wheely thing," said the Arch-Chancellor.
Beside him, a tiny purple spider-like creature materialized out of the air and scuttled towards a crevice. The wizards didn't notice it.
"What wire-baskety wheely thing?"
said the wizards in unison. Ridcully looked around him.
I could have sworn, he began.
There was another scream. Ridcully scrambled to his feet.
"Come on, you fellows,"
he said, limping heroically onwards.